When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You guys know we bring you a lot of first-time CEOs on this podcast, right? I mean, recently we had Deb Liu, who shared her amazing story of taking on her first-time CEO position at Ancestry and how she dove into that new challenge, even though she'd never done anything like that before. Okay, so by the way, you guys should definitely listen to that episode if you haven't already. But what we don't often hear is a story of a first-time CEO who takes over an international restaurant chain at the age of 30, I'm not done, at the age of 30, right before a global pandemic slams the brakes on the entire restaurant industry, and then grows the business by 31% in the pandemic's second year. Okay, but even that isn't the craziest part of this success story. My guest today is Demola Adamolikan. He's Nigerian-born, dreamed of going to an Ivy League school and having a career in investment banking. So how did he end up as the CEO of casual Chinese food chain P.F. Chang's? He's here with me today on his rather unconventional journey to the top and the monumental nightmare he faced just as he took the CEO reins. Demola, welcome to Everyone Talks to Liz. So glad you're here.
Thanks for having me, Liz. It's my pleasure.
Okay. First of all, P.F. Chang's, how much do I love the Mongolian beef?
It's the best in the world. You know, I think that was one of the key things we loved about the business when we bought it a few years ago, is just how good the product was. So the Mongolian beef, the dumplings, dynamite shrimp, it's a lineup of classics and certainly a strength of the brand.
Oh my God. I mean, I can't tell you, there's one right near my house and thank you. Love that Mongolian beef. Okay. So now that we've got that out of the way, I want to start from the
good place to start. That's a good place to start, Liz, with the food. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way, you know, I want to get to the fact that you are from Nigeria, but you did live in four different countries all before the age of 9, correct? Which countries and what was that like for you?
Yeah, you know, I was born in a small town in Nigeria called Ile-Ife, which is southwestern Nigeria. I lived in Amsterdam for about 2 years when I was young. You know, fun fact, my first language was Dutch when I was running around as a child in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. I lived in Zimbabwe for 2 years in Harare, which is the capital. And then I moved to the United States when I was 9 to Springfield, Illinois. And then started my journey in America.
How many languages do you speak?
I speak 2 well, and a few that I spoke at some point that I can throw out a few lines here and there, but I speak Yoruba, which is the one of the major languages in Nigeria, and I speak English well. And then I spoke Shona, which is the language in Zimbabwe, and then I spoke Dutch for a period of time when I was younger. Sure. So there's some knowledge floating around in my head somewhere of those other languages, but two that I speak well.
I'm going off on a tangent here, but how do you have zero accent of any kind when you speak English? Zero.
You know, when you move around as much as I did when you were young, I think you learn to assimilate. And it's helpful when you're still a kid because you can pick up the accents more quickly. But the other thing I will say is when I was young, my dad used to travel to America and he'd bring back movies and cartoons. So I watched a lot of American media, even when I was living in Nigeria. So in school in Nigeria, I'd use American words that, you know, Nigeria was a former British colony. So there was always a little, I was the one using the American spellings and the American words when everybody else was using the British. So I think it was meant to be that I'd end up here and that I'd, I got a head start in terms of American English, even when I was in Nigeria.
Well, sure. I mean, most Nigerians who are born and raised, at least even in part Nigeria, have a slight British accent when they speak English. You're full-blown American, and maybe part of the reason that you moved around so much is that your dad, a famed neurologist, correct? Tell me about that.
That's right. So my dad is a neurologist. He studies diseases and the impact on the brain. So, you know, as a young doctor, he tackled a challenge in southwestern Nigeria. There was a disease that was causing people to fall out and have strokes, and nobody really knew what was causing it. And it wasn't heavily studied. It affected mostly poor regions in Nigeria. And, you know, he did a lot of work. He took on the challenge and he discovered the cause and ultimately published a report that led to the cure. So he received a lot of international attention as a result. You know, he got to travel the world a bit, was invited to New York by the American Neurological Society to present. And that was his first time in America. You know, he arrived and presented his work and was really taken by how much people here valued medicine and science and academia. And at the opportunities here, you know, he talked to his colleagues and heard their stories and, you know, made a decision that he wanted to bring his family here. And the rest of my journey was kind of a path to America because, you know, it's a pretty complicated process. So all the different stops were for reasons related to the immigration to America. But, you know, we moved here and when I was 9 years old in 1998 and, you know, been here since.
Were you welcomed? How did it feel being an immigrant at such a young age? We talk to a lot of immigrant CEOs who, you know, often talk about how they felt like the only one. They stuck out wherever they were. Which city were you in where you began your American life?
Well, you know, my first feeling of being, you know, very different was actually in Zimbabwe. We lived there for 2 years before Nigeria. And, you know, those who aren't familiar with African geography, Nigeria is in the west, Zimbabwe is far in the south. It's like going from Britain to Moldova, like both in Europe, but very different.
Sure.
So, you know, I landed in Zimbabwe when I was seven, you know, didn't speak the language, didn't know the food, understand the culture, et cetera. So I learned to assimilate, you know, there. And, you know, one of the things that I learned when I got to America was very similar, right? Everything was different. The language was different. The people were different, but I'd had that experience. So I actually assimilated quite well. And one thing that helped me in Zimbabwe was, you know, I was always a very good athlete. And as a young boy, even if you don't, you can be as different as different can be, but if you're really good at the sport that people care about, people end up accepting you, right? So I played soccer when I was a kid and I got there and I was, you know, immediately one of the best in Zimbabwe and on our team. And all of a sudden everybody wanted to be my friend.
Nice.
Right? So I got to Illinois, the sport that people cared about there was not soccer, it was basketball. So I picked up basketball and got good at that and made some friends. So, you know, it's a challenge certainly, but I think I learned, you know, people are people no matter where you are in the world. And there's certain, you know, when you get there and you're different, you're going to be the other, right? And it's, you know, who's this African kid? And, you know, all the, it's difficult at first, but, you know, my younger brother was very charming and very good with people. So he made friends just by taking any jokes and turning it around and making people laugh and they loved him. Right. And I learned that from him. And I also learned that, you know, if you're good at things, you know, for me, it was sports at the time. If you can excel at things, people will accept you and appreciate you. And so that was part of my process as a child was just coming in and, you know, taking on whatever people did and being better, you know, being the best at it. And
well, fight through
people,
it. You know,
yeah,
you fight
people,
through it.
Exactly.
So you go to Brown University, Ivy League. That was one of your dreams. And then you get your MBA at Harvard.
Mm.
Wow. I mean, that's a double whammy, isn't it?
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. I went to go join Paulson & Company after I graduated from Harvard.
And what happens? What is your first opportunity where you get a chance to help with the deal that eventually brings P.F. Chang's to your forefront of your life?
Yeah, you know, so I worked for John for a couple of years before the P.F. Chang's deal came out. And that's important because, you know, over those couple of years, you know, I was tasked with some pretty important things. You know, I oversaw a couple of portfolios on his behalf. I at some point he needed help with the healthcare portfolio and it wasn't my background, but I, you know, I dove in and I figured it out and helped him manage that, did some merger arbitrage, a different type of investing, you know, did some retail equity investing. There was a gold mining board that he needed a director on. So I took that on. I joined the board. I traveled to Alaska, visited the mines, like became involved in that. So I was doing a lot for him over the couple of years and, you know, he learned to trust me and trust my work ethic and judgment. And so when this deal came about, actually came about from a guy I used to work with at Goldman. an investment banker who was now selling, he worked at Bank of America, and he was now selling P.F. Chang's. So it was a sell side process, you know, pretty traditional. The people who owned it wanted to sell it. They hired a bank to go find suitors to buy it from them. Right. So, you know, it landed on my desk. He said, hey, listen, I know you guys don't do a lot of private equity, but I thought this was interesting. So I looked at it, shared it with John. He thought it was worth spending time on. So I did a bunch of work to figure out the situation, what's going on with the business, how's it performing, how good is the brand, how good are the products, what are they doing from a marketing perspective, the real estate. So I spent about 3 or 4 months just understanding everything and developing a point of view as to whether we wanted to own it or not. And if we did, what the plan was going to be, like, what's the thesis, what's the strategy, right? And John was very involved in that. So, you know, at the end of the period, I gave him a recommendation. I wrote a thesis around it and shared it with John. And you know, he is a visionary, right? It's not what he does typically, but he saw an opportunity and gave us the green light. So, you know,
can I stop you there? I have to stop you there. As you're putting this plan together, did you ever envision that somebody would say, okay, now you run it?
No. Investing is like you're a spectator in a horse race, right? Like, you do a lot of work to figure out what horse you think is going to win. You bet on it, and other people ride the horse. That's what investing typically is, right? You make decisions, and it's judgment based, and you pull in all the facts and you make decisions, but you're not typically in charge of executing, right? So no, I didn't, that wasn't the plan. That's not what I knew. I joined the board on behalf of John, so I'd be close to the operations, sort of, you know, from a director position, but no, I wasn't thinking I'd become CEO at that point.
And then you find yourself in charge because, long story short, they say, listen, you were the one who put us in touch with this company, and you know it inside and out. You got to fix it, because it wasn't a horrific situation, but there were a lot of things that could be changed. So you find yourself at the helm of this huge restaurant chain. I mean, did you have any experience with Chinese food at all?
Well, you know, what happened is, you know, before I became CEO, so when we did the deal, that was the beginning of 2019. And you're right, the company wasn't in horrific shape, but there was a lot we wanted to transform. So it wasn't an investment where we just put in money and, you know, wanted them to keep doing what they were doing. There were a lot of things we wanted to change with the guest experience, with the off-premise dining, our digital orientation. So we brought in a fantastic CEO, though he was more focused on the nuts and bolts operations and had less time for all this transformation that we wanted to do, right? So things were moving too slowly in terms of some of the digital investments we wanted to make specifically. You know, I wanted an app, you know, wanted the e-commerce engine and all these different things. And, you know, I call from New York and, you know, what's going on, and, you know, you kind of get a story, and nothing really happened unless I came to Scottsdale and, you know, would pull people together and ask questions and actually drive it. And, you know, I'm responsible for the deal, you know, to John. So John asked me, like, what's going on? And I can't be in New York saying, I think they're working on it. I don't know. Right. So I just start coming out to actually make sure that I was on top of things. Right. So I flew out to Scottsdale every week for a year. I'd come out on Monday, fly back on Thursday, spend days with the team and with the CEO. And, you know, I had a great relationship with the CEO we brought in. John Antiocco is his name. And, you know, after a couple of weeks of me coming out, he's like, listen, if you're going to be here, let's give you a title so that, you know, you can have an actual reporting structure and people can, you know, you're not just money from ownership, you have a title at the company, right? So, you know, he wanted me to become chief strategy officer at the company. So I took that to Paulson. He approved. So I had a dual role. I was chief strategy officer at P.F. Chang's, and I still was a partner at Paulson, right? Mm-hmm. So I was doing both. Which I say that just to say that I didn't just drop in a CEO from not being involved at all. I spent a year as chief strategy officer driving a lot of our transformative initiatives. So when the CEO transition came, I'd spent a year more or less helping John Antiocco, the CEO, and being kind of a shadow CEO, you know, making decisions with him, going through the operations with him, joining the field visits, spending time with the teams, visiting the restaurants, leading some of the initiatives, so that when I took over, it was a lot smoother transition than it might sound if I would have just dropped in from you know, directly from Paulson.
Mm-hmm. Of course. We're not done yet. We'll be back in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate.
However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Okay, you get the call. You're now the CEO. What was your first thought? I mean, you had never run a restaurant chain. Had you ever been a waiter? I mean, what experience did you have?
I'd been a waiter. That helps in a way, but that's not. I was a waiter in high school. Obviously I led the deal. So I think the most important thing was I knew exactly what we were trying to achieve. I wrote the thesis along with John Paulson, and organizations that fail, a lot of times it's based on a misalignment or unclear directives between ownership, management, and the people executing on the ground, right? When you have perfect alignment, it's a lot easier to win. There's a lot of different ways to win in life, but everybody needs to kind of agree as to what you're doing. And when you don't have that agreement, things can go south very quickly, right? So the number one thing in me coming in was that I could align the organization around a very clear vision that came directly from ownership. So there's no daylight between ownership and management at that mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. And I could deliver a clear message in terms of strategy. And that was kind of my first thing I felt like, we needed to fix, right? Because there was a little uncertainty as to what was actually the plan and what we're going to do. So that was one. And the other thing I'll say is, I came in the middle of a crisis, right? So there wasn't a lot of time to doubt myself or ask a lot of questions. The decision was made and, it was my deal. I was responsible for it. So I wasn't worried. I just was problem solving from the moment it was my responsibility. Right. So restaurants are closed. When can we open them? How many? What's the schedule? Like this immediately was like, we got to get through this crisis first before anything else can really be, to allow ourselves a chance of success in the future. Right. So, yeah. It was two things. It was the tactical problem solving of dealing with COVID and dealing with closed restaurants and making sure that we could service our debt and negotiating with the lenders, negotiating with landlords and all these different things that needed to happen just to survive the moment.
Just to survive.
And just to survive the moment, right? You have a moment you need to survive, and then you have a long-term plan and a vision and a strategy that you need to get people aligned to, right? So I was trying to do both, right? Because you can't be so, caught in the weeds on the present that you forget about the future, what you're trying to achieve. And so you survive the present, you have no plan, no alignment. And at the same time, you can't be so forward-thinking that you don't survive the present. Right. So the biggest challenge was doing both. Right. Not to add more challenges, but when I took over, then we had another situation, which was the riots that took place after the George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, which, right. Began as protests and ended up being destructive riots in some of our restaurants. So the day I took over was the weekend after that happened. So I had all these things I was trying to solve. And then a bunch of restaurants that were vandalized and damaged and some of the looting that took place. It was a lot to deal with at once. But it was kind of, step by step. My first email was going to be a strategic email to kind of align the organization on strategy. I threw that in the trash can and instead addressed the George Floyd situation, which I thought was more important in that moment, given Agreed. That was the headline and that was what everybody was thinking about and everybody was talking about.
Yes.
I had to be fluid. I had to be nimble. There was a lot going on, but we got through that period. We have a great team. Our COO was on top of the operational side of things. We were able to make it through and then ultimately get to, some of the success you mentioned, especially in our second year.
Well, that's the interesting part. In 2019, you started ramping up. And of course, this is before the pandemic, the app, and to make sure that there was this opportunity for takeout, because up until then, you guys really didn't have that. I mean, all Chinese food should be takeout, as far as I'm concerned, at least have that offering. But then the pandemic hits. And, what kind of challenge did you face in getting the word out that, yes, P.F. Chang's does takeout? We can feed you guys even in the worst of times.
Yeah, so you're 100% right. The key was that the infrastructure was built during 2019 and the year leading up to the pandemic. So once we had the ability for people to order on our app and on our website, then it became a marketing conversation, right? So we ramped up our digital marketing, both in terms of the email messaging that we sent. We had a loyalty file at the time that was around 6 or 7 million people. It's about 10 million now. So leveraging that to get the word out to guests and potential guests. our paid social marketing. So, you know, social media marketing, and making sure that people knew that the app was available, they could download it. It was a great experience. They'd get the best pricing. And so that's something we worked with our marketing team to make sure that we did effectively. And at the same time, you got to make sure the operations are great, right? So if somebody does take the time to download the app and make and place an order, it needs to arrive on time. It needs to arrive fresh. It needs to be what they expected, what they ordered, and they need to leave thinking they had a great experience, right? Because if you attract somebody via marketing and they have a bad experience, you're going to lose them.
Yes.
And that return is going to be low. Mm. If you attract somebody via marketing and they have a tremendous experience, they're going to come back and they're going to come back and they're going to come back. And the lifetime value of, you know, whatever money you spent to attract that guest is going to be very high, right? So you know, it was marketing and then it was operations to make sure that when people did come in, they had a great off-premise experience. And that's what really led to our success.
I do have to finish by asking you, what do you think was the one characteristic you either had or developed as you took the reins of P.F. Chang's during such a difficult time that all entrepreneurs out there, young or old, anybody listening who dreams of starting a business, what was that characteristic you feel you had that helped you survive and helped you keep the company alive during what all companies face at some point or another in their life, and that is a near-death experience?
You know, I think what I would say is the most important characteristic in a situation like that is transparency. You know, people are smart and they know what's going on in the world. And if you hide things from them, they can feel that. And so I think it's important to be upfront about the situation. You know, like I said, the one of the first things I did was send out a long email detailing the challenges we were facing. Mm-hmm. I had a town hall when I joined, walked through the balance sheet, walked through the P&L, walked through our strategy to survive COVID and what we're going to need to do. And when you do that and they feel like they're part of the solution, then they're going to be more energized to fight. And more energized to take a hell for you because you brought them into the tent versus if they don't know what's happening, you're not communicating, you're just giving directives and they don't know how it fits in, there's going to be a lot less enthusiasm. And so I'm honest and transparent naturally. That wasn't something I had to fake or learn, but I think it's critical, right? And, you know, I'd go to the field, I'd you know, go to restaurants. I had a town hall in Texas and, you know, I remember I had a deck that I walked through that again was very transparent about our situation and what we were expecting from them and what our strategy was going to be going forward. And the market partner in Texas, a guy named Paul Anderson, you know, he's been in the company for 20 plus years, you know, a Texas guy that's very well respected within the organization. And he kind of asked me, he's like, listen, you know, we've had three CEOs come in the last 3 years and yeah. Everybody has a different plan. And,
right.
You know, how do I know this isn't going to change? He's like, he goes, if you promise me this plan isn't going to change, I promise you we'll be able to deliver, right?
Right.
You know, I could look him in the eye and say, you know, this plan is comes from ownership. It's, you know, there's no confusion about what we're doing. You know, I can promise you this plan isn't going to change, and I'll stand by that, right? So it's looking people in the eye and being honest and being transparent and letting them know what we're doing and why, letting them ask questions because yes. If you believe in your plan, you should be comfortable being questioned about it. And you know, people bought in, right? And the energy was different, the enthusiasm was different, and that's an important thing to, because you can't sit in your headquarters and run a business like this and expect that you're gonna lead it to success yourself. Like, you need a lot of people bought in. You need a lot of people to believe and understand.
Yes, the troops. The troops
so,
have to follow you.
Yeah, it's rallying the troops, and you know, there's a quote that I like that well, it's from the Song of Ice and Fire novels, which is what they made the Game of Thrones books or shows rather out of.
Right.
And the quote is, know your men and let them know you. Don't ask them to die for a stranger. It's Ned Stark, for anybody who watches the show, says that in the books. But I love that quote because people need to know who they're following and why and what the objective is and what the plan is. You know, transparency and knowing the team, like me going out there meant a lot to people, right? Like me going to Texas, me going to California, me going to New York and sitting down with people, you know, it means a lot. So I'd say transparency, which I said, and then availability, like being out there.
Yes.
And having a presence, especially when times are hard, are the key things to are some of the key traits you can have in a moment like that?
Well, Damola, you've got to get people to follow you into battle. And I think that's a great analogy. And you have, at least for now, figured it out. The company is growing. You, of course, started PF Chang's To Go, which is a huge success. And we can't wait to continue following your story. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And everybody, PF Chang's, have the Mongolian beef.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. It's to
and
die
the chicken
for.
Chicken lettuce wraps. I'll plug that as well. That's
oh, yeah.
our top seller.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about those. Yeah. Forgot about those. Don't look at the fat content. Just look at the protein content. Great to have you, Damola. And you guys,
my pleasure.
What do I tell you? You know, look at this guy. I mean, he was moving all over the world. He always had to adjust. He had to change. He saw opportunities. And when there weren't opportunities, he made them for himself. And that's what I need you to glean from these kinds of stories. And I know you do. And we've been getting such great feedback from you guys. And most of all, the fact that you're downloading and listening means so much to me. Spread the word about Everyone Talks to Liz. OMG. Oh, my God. Listen, you can see me versus just listening to me Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern on Fox Biz every week. So I hope to see you and to have you join me once again. Thanks so much. And we'll see you next time.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.